Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 167. Thank you for tuning in, guys. You know what? This is the first male guest I've had on in over a month. The last one was Doc Brown, and that was 6 episodes ago. That doesn't mean anything. We've just had some amazing female guests. If you missed them, last week was Ashlyn B, which was fantastic, amazingly popular one. I had the special with Ben and Jerry's, which was about ice cream, but it was also with the IRC, so it was also about refugees. Had Sophie Hagen, Laurie Penny, Alice Lowe, who I adore, and then it was Doc Brown, and before that was Laura Dockrill, and yeah, it's been loads of good people. How have you all been, guys? Today's episode is fantastic. It's with Will Poulter, who I've been a fan of for a while, and we've been talking about him coming on for a while and never got round to it. And then I got hit up by his PR people to have him on to talk about Detroit, which is out now and is absolutely amazing. And as you'll hear from the podcast, I highly recommend people go and see it in the cinema. I urge you to, but more about that shortly. And the problem with PR things is it can all be a bit rushed and a bit of a nightmare. So I kind of hit Will up privately and said, look, it's why this is the week after he was doing all the PR. I was like, look, you're going to have a hectic week having to talk to absolutely everyone about this film. So I'd rather, if you're up for it, we meet up next week and we have a more relaxed chat. So we did exactly that. Before we get into it, I should mention, obviously, speechdevelopmentrecords.com. The sponsor every episode. Head over there. We've got some amazing stuff. We've got some good clothes. Do any of you do this when I mention it? If you've heard this a million times and you've never gone to speechdevelopmentrecords.com, just as a little favour or just as a laugh, just go over there and have a look now. It's free to look. No purchase necessary. You can go and have a look. Oh, I should also mention, oh Lord, if anyone follows me on social media, you'll know about this because I posted about it quite excitedly quite a bit. But the reaction to my new a range of trainers has been absolutely insane. Thank you all so much for being as hyped as I was. The fact is, and I've not mentioned this much, and I think they were originally meant to come out almost 3 months ago, and there were some issues and hold ups. So I've been insanely excited about them. I'm so proud of how they look, of how they're made, of everything about them. So the excitement and tension has built hugely for me, and I was worried that I was going to finally launch them and my overexcitement would be countered by people being like, can you chill out about these? But thankfully, the excitement was met. I honestly didn't have a single person complain about, I think I did about, 9 posts probably about it on the day of launch, because I was really excited. And I didn't have a single person complain, genuinely. So thank you all for either supporting or for just biting your tongue and not moaning at me because of my clear excitement. So thank you for that. Is there anything else I need to tell you about? Ireland. I'm bringing the Distraction Pieces podcast to Ireland for the first time ever. And it's the only live podcast I'm going to be doing this year. And possibly for a while, or for the foreseeable future. So please come along to this. I urge you. It's Dublin Podcast Festival. I'm going to be at the Tivoli Theatre September 21st. And then on the 23rd, I'm back in London at the book club for We Are Lizards, joined by previous Distraction Pieces podcast guest, Huey Morgan. So yeah, come down and check that out at the book club September 23rd. What else do I have to tell you about? Next week's podcast, I've not recorded it yet. It's going to be a last minute one. But next week's podcast guest should be Eddie Izzard, which will be great. And then, man, I've got some good ones lined up. I've got Hugo from the Maccabees, or formerly of the Maccabees, obviously. Really good chat. I've chatted to a woman called Soad McHennett, who is the Washington Post essentially terrorism journalist and has been out all over the world and sat down with members of ISIS and members of Al-Qaeda. And it's one of the most amazing conversations I've ever had. I can't hype it enough. She's an amazing woman who's got a book out called I Was Told to Come Alone, or They Told Me to Come Alone. It's mind-blowing, the things that she's done, the risk she's put herself at. She's a Muslim woman that's grown up in the West, so she's kind of uniquely positioned, or perfectly, not uniquely, but perfectly positioned to go and have these discussions and to look at it from both sides. I won't go into too much detail. I recorded it yesterday. It's not going to be out for a few weeks, but it blew my mind, honestly. And realizing that there's a massive misunderstanding in the difference between trying to gain understanding and having sympathy. They're two different things. To sit down with these people is a positive move. It's not being sympathetic. It's trying to understand it all, because it's a horrific situation. But anyway, that's in a few weeks. Got some good podcasts on their way. Hopefully next week I'm going to be chatting to the legendary Helen Chamberlain. I love Helen, of Soccer AM, who is no longer on Soccer AM. And I struggle to imagine Soccer AM without Helen. So I'm looking forward to talking to her about, a 22-year career on the same show. Amazing. So yeah, a lot of good guests to come is what I'm telling you. But right now, I'm joined by Will Poulter. And I hope you enjoy it. It's a really good chat. He's a lovely young man, insanely talented, and crazy that he's such a young lad. So there's a lot ahead for this kid. I'll be back at the end. I'll mention again now, please do, or you're going to listen to podcasts. You're going to want to go and see Detroit after you've listened to this. I'll see you not next week. What am I doing? This is the intro, not the outro. I'll see you at the end of the episode, all right? I'm a bit confused. All right, so I'll see you in a bit. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. And I sat down with Mike Skinner and spent 10 minutes setting up as I've just done. And he just laughed at me and said, you know, you can record these on an iPhone now, right? It's completely true. But I lug my heavy gear around London. And I like it as a little extra workout.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The stairs up here took me by surprise. I literally was like, I'll run up, and I got to the top to say hello, and everyone's like, you're right. I'm here to talk to Will.
Dude, that's me twice a week. It's hard enough carrying your phone.
Classic podcast. I've started mid-sentence to be all DIY. I'm chatting with Will Poulter. How are you?
I'm really well, man. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thanks so much for taking the time in the middle of what is, you know, I'd imagine a hectic week with Detroit coming out. I mean, this will be going out in a week and a half.
Okay.
But as we sit here now, it comes out on Friday.
It does.
Doesn't it? So how are you feeling on that?
That's crazy, man. Yeah, no, very timely. You know, I feel really honoured to be a part of this thing.
Yeah.
Genuinely. And I think, you know, as an actor, I think, and you know, you feel lucky to be part of any project.
Yeah,
It's a blessing to work at all. But if you're fortunate enough to kind of be part of something that seems to do more than just entertain and also kind of make a comment on what is going on right now and hopefully be something that contributes to the progress. And
yeah.
I don't want to say anything as profound as like solving the issues that it addresses, but at the least engaging people in a conversation about race relations.
100%. And we were discussing the other day how it's depressingly timely as such. I'm sure when everyone was making it, obviously, you know, there's been a decline or at least an increase in exposure of injustices towards the black community in America in recent years. But when you were filming it, I mean, I guess you couldn't have imagined it. It just seems to have ramped up and up and up. So it seems, I think the beauty of it is it's speaking on the subject whilst not speaking directly on
the very raw situation that's happening at the moment. It's telling a story from the past and showing what went wrong and what the issues were. So I feel, for me, it feels like beautiful timing to have these conversations, address this subject without being confrontational on look what you did on this date or look what they did here. Do you know what I mean? It's looking at the past and going, look, this isn't cool, man. This isn't how it should be.
I think you're right. I think it's not as explicit as that, but you actually put it really well when we chatted the other day and we did that Mobo screening.
Yeah.
And Mobo did a kind of collaboration with E1. And you said that, you know, we must be sort of heartbroken to have one of the most well-timed releases of all time. And that is really it. We're kind of, you know, I think very enthused by the fact that this film seems to be making a relevant and much needed comment on a, you know, a heartbreaking issue that is, you know, not just having an effect in the States, but, you know, on a global scale.
Yeah, 100%.
At the same time, I think we wish we'd never had to make this film in the first place because 50 years on, it should not be relevant in the slightest. And to see such strong parallels between what's explored in this film and what's going on right now is scary. And as you said, it's only grown in relevance since we made it, which is, again, the last thing that you'd expect.
100%.
You expect as time goes on, we evolve, and it sort of feels like we're experiencing a regression in many respects.
Completely. And when I heard that this film was coming out, it excited me hugely because it is odd that things like what happened in Detroit that is told here, but also the LA riots in 65 and in 92 and everything in between are such important stories with such complexities. The in 92, the way it ended up escalating to the black community against the Asian community, and it was all these kind of, and the police and all this, it was this backbiting and infighting, and these stories haven't really been explored in drama and in fiction. Now, they're explored in documentaries an awful lot, but I think documentaries are an interesting one because it's only in recent years that Netflix has allowed people to realise that anyone can watch a documentary.
Right.
You don't have to be a highbrow person sitting at home going, I'm going to watch a documentary.
That's so true,
The lack of risk in Netflix, like you've already paid for it, it's just there, allowed people with Making a Murderer and with numerous other things, with Keepers, with loads of others, just go, all right, I'll put this on, and it's opened that up, which is great, but I think there's something in dramas that still opens up even more to people who wouldn't watch a documentary, to people who wouldn't go, I want to explore this subject, and that's really important, and that's what I thought was great about they try it. And the thing that struck me throughout, really, I mean, there's kind of a midpoint that gets all the heavier, but at least in the first half, the sheer joy and happiness and lightheartedness of the film, the genuine humour in the film, was a beautiful surprise for me. It would have been easy for this film to go, here's the serious subject, here's the bad guys, here's the good guys, and so on and so forth, but it blurs those lines. I thought your character, I mean, the thing that amazed me about your performance is, even till the end, he is the bad guy as such, but he isn't aware that he's a bad guy. And I think that's one of the most, the thing that strikes me the most in great performances is, it's easy to be the villain, but it's far more nuanced and realistic to know that the villain doesn't think he's the villain. The villain thinks he's just reacting. The villain just thinks he's doing what's right at the time. And that's what I thought was really interesting about this portrayal. I said, easy to it would have been very easy to make a very clear the police are the bad guys type film. And whilst there's a lot of that undeniable, there is nuances and there is layers and there is a story being told. So. So how was that, and how was it to represent a true events? Obviously dramatised, and some bits have to, you know, fill in the blanks, but how was the pressure in that of representing these events?
Yeah, first of all, I appreciate that, man. I mean, I think, as you said, you know, if you were sort of forced to point out who the villain in this story is, that there would be kind of not much hesitation over pointing the finger at my character, and I too would fully highlight him as the villain if forced to. But I think one thing that I was keen to do was not encourage anyone to empathize with him whatsoever, because I don't think he's in any case a well-intentioned sort of cop who made a mistake at any point. I think, as you said, he has these very kind of offensive, misguided opinions and a very violent and racist agenda that he wholeheartedly and self-righteously believes in.
Yeah.
So he thinks he's right, as you pointed out, and that's the scariest thing. And the fact that he is so confident about the fact that he's right, when in fact it's so obvious that he's wrong, is kind of the scariest thing. And it was important to humanize him so as to make him identifiable within society then and now, I think was the 100%. Point.
There's that saying that we don't allow monsters to walk around in our society.
Mm.
We allow normal looking people.
Mm.
And that's kind of the beauty there, because it's true. If we go too far to go, well, they're clearly evil and you can identify it a mile off, it's like, well, no, that's not what the problem is. These are humans, and they might not be evil as such. They might just have a few things that are on the wrong level, a few unforgivable misguidings and, do you know what I mean, errors in judgment or view or opinion. But it's an inaccurate portrayal, and I think it's something that happens a lot, particularly on social media at the moment, that everyone who has a slightly not left-leaning opinion is a Nazi. It's like, well, no, we need to be able to properly identify the genuine fucking Nazis. Yeah, do you know what I mean? We don't want to blur that and give them totally somewhere to hide. It's like, it's important to have that balance. So, totally. Well, no, they're not all Nazis. These ones carrying Nazi flags, they're fucking Nazis, and it can blur that line. So that's what I liked about this, about your performance and the way the film was put across in general, was, as I said, those nuances, the humanising elements, in no way forgiving. And as I said, by the end, I feel it's very clear who everyone is, who's good and who's bad, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. I think there's a certain amount of, or a great amount of protection that's offered by not actually putting labels on things that are, you know, unarguably one thing. I mean, the recent, you know, riotous behavior of white supremacists in Charlottesville, you know, that those individuals are, they're Nazis, they're white supremacists before they are anything else. And I think when 100%. You know, someone like Trump in his position fails to identify them correctly, then all it does is send a very dangerous and widespread message that, you know, we shouldn't call those people out, we shouldn't make examples of them. And I think that's a call to all creatives when it comes to representing these kind of people on screen, to do it as unapologetically, as you put it, you know, as possible, because we don't want to offer them any more protection. I mean, they've already got the protection that comes with being, you know, that comes with white privilege.
Yeah.
You know, they already have an assumption of innocence and a protection, a natural sense of protection against against guilt. So to sort of embolden them any more, you know, with comments like the fact, you know, I think Trump described some of the people in that rally as very fine people, you know, amongst them were some very fine people, you know, things like that are just so dangerous.
100%. It's, I mean, it always comes back in this situation to me, that in situations where racism is rife, it's not enough to not be racist. You have to be anti-racist. You have to be fighting that. So if there are some people in there who aren't, oh, I'm not actually a Nazi, it's like, well, you were walking next to them, and that's
standing shoulder to shoulder.
It's similar. I mean, it comes again in, I think, the job of a police officer is one of the hardest in the world.
Absolutely.
Yet, again, it touches in this, not all the police officers are equally evil as such, but
totally,
by standing by quietly or by not standing up in these situations, you're coercing in that. You're part of that. You're part of that problem. So whilst it's, again, I think it's lazy to say the whole all cops are bastards type thing, all that. It's like, they're not. But again, it's going to, all of these solutions are going to come from the black community and the white community and the police. It needs everyone to solve this problem. Totally. It doesn't just take one to say, you're wrong, fuck you kind of thing. It takes everyone to go, we're wrong a bit too. Yeah. Oh, and we're kind of wrong here. Yeah, you know, it's everyone addressing that.
100%, man. I mean, that's the truth of the matter, that this is a everybody problem.
Yeah.
And it can be an everybody solution for the same reason. I was also concerned about the fact that my representation of this particular police officer might communicate that I think badly of all police. And the first thing I have to be honest about is, of course, that my experience with the police is founded on the fact that I am a young, straight, white, middle-class male. It's very unique. There's pretty much no prejudice, and it's quite possible that I could go through my entire life and experience nothing but unbiased, hardworking, honest, you know, well-intentioned police officers.
Yeah.
And I believe there are a great many of those.
100%.
But when it comes to individuals like Philip Krause, my character in Detroit, it's about making an example of those individuals and throwing them under the bus, you know, holding them up as something that we cannot afford to allow in our society.
Completely.
Much less in positions of power. And, you know, I think it must be heartbreaking for, you know, good, hardworking, honest police officers to see cases where they have been let down by their fellow officers.
Yeah.
And they have witnessed police officers who are wearing essentially the same uniform and a badge with the same level of prestige attached to it, and they're committing murders.
Yeah.
And furthermore, they're then walking away from those experiences, you know, without being met with the kind of convictions that they should be met with. I remember reading a comment from an African-American police officer who served in Baton Rouge.
Mm-hmm.
Where actually I can't remember exactly the details of the case, but there was a case where a innocent person of color had been killed by the police.
Yeah.
And then there was a retaliation against the police.
Right.
By a couple of African-American men. And there was a statement made by an African-American police officer on Facebook, on his personal Facebook. And he said one of the most heartbreaking things, both as a black man and as a police officer, was to see people look at him with shame, regard him with a sort of negative judgment.
Yeah.
As if to say, how dare you as a black man wear that uniform? Because by wearing that uniform, it implies that you don't stand with black people. And I think the crux of his statement was, I wear this uniform to serve and protect everybody.
Yeah.
And in particular, as a black man, I'm in this position to try and ensure that my 100%. Own people are not being...
It should be all the more important to have that integration and familiarity. So right. that if you are a young black man in Baton Rouge, you know, not an easy area, to see in what would be a moment of fear when you potentially see that badge glistening,
yes.
to see a familiar face, a there black face, and feel... So, because again, it's on both sides. It can be on both sides. It can be the natural reaction of panic when the police come because you are of an ethnicity that generally it doesn't end well when the police come.
Mm.
And equally, on the police side, again, not excusing anyone, but it's a tough job. I acknowledge that. If you're Absolutely. In a rough area and you're scared for your life, I mean, you could argue that if there was more... rigorous training and preparation, then that fear wouldn't be there. But you know, if it was truly the great and the good rather than a job vacancy as such, then that's that. But we won't go into that.
No,
again, it is that if you can have that familiarity, if that policeman coming down the road is Mickey's cousin and you recognise him, or if that kid in the hoodie is Jamal's nephew. Do you know what I mean? It's like you've got that familiarity of like, look, you can have that interaction. It's why when my granddad was a policeman, it feels like a better time because it was so local and so communal. You did have Bobby's on the beat. You did have someone who would walk around the neighbourhood and know everyone. They wouldn't only turn up when situations are elevated. That's always going to be a fractious relationship. If you only ever see each other when shit's going down,
that's not going to be
a friendly, engaging, understanding thing. It's going to be a ramped up to 12, always intense interaction. Yeah. Right? So it's a...
100%. And I think it's also important to have, you know, departments of law enforcement that are representative of the communities that they seek to serve and protect.
Yeah.
And I think what you're saying is so true about seeing familiar faces and, you know, having the police force be representative of those communities is kind of one of the first steps. It's been really encouraging to meet with the Detroit Police Department as a part of being, you know, in this film and sort of embarking on the promotional tour. And learning from the chief of police, who's an African-American man by the name of James Craig, that Detroit is now the most diverse police department in the country.
There's amazing things going on in Detroit at the moment. Amazing. Considering, looking back even 10, 15 years, it felt like it was practically a war zone. I remember when we were touring America, Detroit wasn't even an option. It was off the list like 8 years ago. Whereas
a lot of people.
Now there's so much rejuvenation there, so much promotion of new businesses, of black-owned businesses, of stuff from in the community, so that there's that pride and community and unity. And again, the police force is a great example of that.
Amazing example, particularly when you think about when this film was set, which was 1967, the police force was 95% white. So there you've got a community living in fear of a police department that operated with a huge racial bias.
Yeah.
Just straight off the mark because, you know, you were totally outnumbered. I mean, Detroit was approaching 40% African-American at the time. So the stats speak for themselves. But then, of course, there's a presumption of guilt and there were sort of antagonistic arrest tactics being used and, you know, a disproportionate amount of African-American people being arrested for, you know, misdemeanors and non-crimes. And actually, it made me think about Riz Ahmed's comments in Parliament about diversity and actually referring to it more accurately as representation. And I think that's what we need moving forward is across the board, we need a better degree of representation that police departments are representative of the communities that they're in charge of as opposed to, or I shouldn't say in charge of, but looking to protect as opposed to being kind of more diverse.
Yeah.
I think.
Completely. But, I think that's a great point. And I think Riz's comments, I mean, someone could throw that away or pass that off as, oh, it's the entertainment industry. How important is it? It's very fucking important, man, because it's one of the few areas that still has such huge reach with cinema and with TV and with everything. And totally. As I mean, just touching upon on the mention of the LA riots and stuff there, there's now so many great directors and actors and producers who were growing up at that time. And, you know, black artists in this industry who should be tasked with telling that story, and it's an amazing and powerful thing. I think, again, we touched upon when we were discussing at the Mobos thing, it's easy to dismiss the arts as frivolous. I mean, a lot of people there's been a few points recently at award ceremonies where political statements have been made and people have gone, sit down, actor, actress, or whatever else. It's like, it's crazy, but it's a valid thing. And I mentioned
that is genuine madness to me.
I saw a post the other day. I can't think who it was by Anna Paquin, because she had posted about something political, and someone had posted saying actors and comedians and musicians stick to entertaining. we don't need your opinions. It's like her point quite quick was, you forget the other labels I have as mother and member of community. It's like.
Right.
And my thought is, so just because they've got a talent here, their views are are written off. But
right.
the thing that I was mentioning on that night was a film from 1962 called Victim. And it was the first film, I believe, certainly in British cinema, to speak favourably of homosexuals. Of homosexuals, it was still illegal then.
Mm.
And a Victim is seen by many as being influential in the changing of that law, because it addressed the fact, at that point, it was a big thing. Blackmail was a huge thing for anyone who was homosexual and of any wealth, because it was such an area of shame.
Mm.
Or it was illegal, it was shame and all this. So people were being blackmailed constantly to keep their sexuality a secret. And this film addressed that, and it had a policeman in there who was the only one in all the rest of the policemen who spoke as sympathetically of these poor gay people who were just living their thing. And stuff like that, I mean, even more so then when there was limited media reach, but stuff like that would be watched by the masses and by the public and would start to turn that over again. Totally. Detroit will get more bums in seats at the cinema than a documentary being released. Like, not a lot of documentaries are getting big cinema releases. There are some, obviously, but not lots are getting that. So that's an important thing, right? To know that people are going to be sitting down of all political beliefs. And I'm not saying they're going to a racist is going to watch it and have his mind changed, but he might see little bits that are familiar and see bits from slightly different angles that he wouldn't choose to put on a documentary on the LA riots or a documentary on this and that, other than to go, well, that's all wrong and all this, you know?
Totally. Man.
There is a huge power in media in that way.
100%. And I think across the board, I think, you know, your point earlier about platforms like, you know, Netflix, you know, the need for films to be more than just entertainment, to be informational, to be nourishing. You know, I think throughout history, we've seen the effect of movies, TVs, music, all media as a form of escapism from reality.
Yeah.
But I think what we do undermine and what people continue to undermine is how creatives and what they create can actually benefit society. And when you 100%. Drill down on the role of a creative or a performer, historically speaking, it has been to reflect on society and have that work better it.
Yeah.
Have that work potentially point out social ailments and offer a way of improving it. And that's why I get particularly pissed off when people say things like stay in your lane. It's like, I'm in my lane.
Yeah. Yeah.
As far as I see it, I'm driving as smoothly as I possibly can in my lane, so long as I'm creating stuff that isn't just vacuous bullshit. And you know, if I
and I mean I'd want to add, there is a place for all of it. There's a place for cinema where I'm just eating popcorn and I'm forgetting, but there's a place for when I'm challenged more, and that's
totally.
That's what makes it beautiful. If every film was really hard work, then a lot less people would go and see films.
Entirely.
It's the balance of the two that it's you can go, it's this escape, but equally, oh, they've slipped this in. Oh, shit.
Right.
I didn't realise that.
And,
you know?
And to be told that there's sort of no place for anything outside of creating the work itself is quite depressing, because again, historically speaking, you know, art has been there to try and improve and better society. So I get equally frustrated by those comments. And I think, you know, as you said, there's a place for all of it, and there is absolutely nothing wrong than, you know, watching a film that is just a roller coaster. It's just you know, one of those sort of popcorn movies that people often, you know, can sometimes kind of label them as. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And Jesus, I've been in them, and I may well continue to be in them.
Yeah.
But I also think that there's a way of lacing films that you would never assume to have or need kind of socio-political commentary.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way of actually including that in those sorts of films. 100%. John Boyega made the point on this recent press tour. He said people are forgetting how Star Wars, from the off, you know, even in a film that might be labelled as the ultimate blockbuster, you know, yeah, sci-fi, totally fantastical, all of these things, you know, from the off that had, you know, a sort of socio-political edge to it. You know, there are themes of mutiny, there are themes of dictatorship, there are 100%. Themes of social injustice, there are themes of poverty, there are themes of classism, you know. And people are kind of eating their vegetables without even realising it when they watch a Star Wars film.
You can be as heavy-handed or as subtle as you like, and Star Wars is a great example of the ultimate popcorn film. But, again, you've got things like Riz Ahmed, as we mentioned earlier, commenting that, you know, when he grew up at Christmas, it's a Christmas film, it comes out in December, at Christmas he couldn't buy an action figure of someone that looked like him as a young brown boy in England. Whereas he was saying he was in Star Wars, and as small a difference as that is, young Asian boys could buy an action figure of Riz, and that would be their main toy, and they'd be excited. So it doesn't have to be we're telling the story of Detroit, a great racial injustice and social injustice. It can be, well, we're just getting more variation in the casting process and in the characters and things like that. And these small subtle things can make a massive difference, particularly to young minds that haven't been tarnished by the ills of society yet. If you're naturally just growing up and watching a multitude of races and colours and creeds on your screen, it's going to be easier to accept a multitude of races and colours and creeds in your street, on next door to you, in your school, you know?
Totally, totally, man. I think that is such a good point. I think if we're going to kind of nurture the future, then we need to be looking at the kind of media that we're subjecting our kids to,
yeah,
and the media that is being made for young people specifically.
Yeah, completely.
What's that amazing animation film that got a lot of critical acclaim and did really well at the box office too? And it's largely about mental health. It's about a little girl. It's about the characters inside the mind of a little, yes, girl and how they shape her psychology.
Yeah, it's the different parts of her mind, isn't it? What's that called? Right. Inside Out.
Inside Out. Yeah. I mean, like, what a brilliant movie.
Amazing.
And we need more Inside Out and, respectfully, maybe less emoji movies, you know what I mean?
We need
films, I think, and while there's a place for all of it, because, you know, you might go to the emoji movie and have a great time. I guess my point is that there are a lot of films that fit into that bracket and less that fit into the Inside Out.
What excites me is things like Inside Out and even the Lego movie and stuff like that, that they're intelligently written, that they're having huge success. So you don't fall back on, oh, and again, this isn't an anti-emoji movie brand, but I don't fall back on things like, well,
sorry, I didn't mean to open that door either.
No, completely, but it's a great example that it's why I did a post after seeing Detroit saying, urging people to go and see it in the cinema, because number one, I think it's a great film, but number two, the more films like that have a box office success, because the fact is, this is an industry that is always going to be a financially driven in many ways. There's no avoiding that. But the more films like this have a box office success, the more chances that will be given to more films like this, to more things discussing these subjects. Because again, if people go, oh, it's in fashion now to be a social political, it's like, cool, I'm happy with that. I'm fine with that being in fashion now and being a thing. If that can be something that gets those films made and gets those things greenlit and signed off on, and those stars that aren't white, typical Hollywood, bright teeth, smiling, you know, if it opens up those doors, then yeah, I'm cool with that.
Totally, man. And I think, you know, again, without paying too much attention to the emoji movies or similar films, you know, I look at that film and there is a place for it.
Yeah.
But would that film have been hurt by another redraft or two redrafts?
Yeah.
To ensure that it was a bit more nourishing for children and it did have some sort of worthwhile socio-political messaging in it, because kids are going to grow up with emojis.
Yeah.
Like that's going to be more part of their future than it has been for you and I.
Yeah.
And so you can still, in my opinion, have a massively financially successful film, still have it be critically acclaimed and it be socio-politically responsible. No one gets hurt. Everybody wins. I think it's just a bit lazy to create a film with the intention to make a load of money off a current trend. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily the case with Emoji Movie, but
it's an example that we use. And again, it's kind of cool that hopefully that attitude or that outlook will prove old and unsuccessful. Because the fact is, with kids' films, like having two goddaughters and knowing that if there's a film that they like, her parents are going to hear or see that film about 100 times. Yeah. So, you know,
have the theme tune sang in the back of the car.
Some substance in it that you're appealing slightly to the parents, the more openness they're going to have. Oh, yeah, let's put that one on again.
Man.
Do you know what I mean? Rather than let's put this emoji one on again. That's... I mean, we're hating on the emoji.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't even mean to. And I haven't even seen it. That's the truth. I haven't even seen it.
It's got some poor reviews, though.
I've read up on it. But yeah, you know, I think, and I want to reiterate what you said, because there is a place for all of it.
Yeah.
I suppose my question that I'll always hold over any film is, could it have been better?
Yeah.
And whether that means adding extra explosions, which is, you know, less likely, and adding more money to the budget, or is it, you know, could it be improved by really addressing the core themes of the script and analyzing a little more closely what we're actually communicating to our audiences within the sort of finer details of the messaging. And, you know, there's arguments on either side, but I just think there's nothing wrong with asking, you know, whether something could have been better.
100%. And everyone should be trying to ask that along the way. If everyone involved is questioning that, and it's tough because you've been in the industry a long while now. Mm. So I'm sure you've either seen people or woken up on days and felt it yourself. It becomes a job. It becomes a job like any other job. You may not wake up every morning and go, right, today I'm going to absolutely knock this out of the past. You're waking up thinking, totally. Oh, what scenes have I got? Oh, it's a late one. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So it is, I can understand. My awareness is that no one sets out to make a bad movie. So I've got a little bit of lenience and sympathy there, because it's like, well, no one intentionally went, oh, let's phone this in. Totally. I mean, if it happened, happened. But
and also, you know, I mean, I should have prefixed it with this, but like, I'm not saying that everything I've been in is great and couldn't have been better. I mean, on the contrary, like, I'm fully aware of that. I just think, in order for, I think, media to really maximize its potential, we just need to keep a keener eye trained on what's going on around us, because I think to lose sight of it is just irresponsible.
Completely. I mean, let's go all the way back then. I mean, you've got a decent hit rate, I've got to say. I mean, starting off with Son of Rambo, was that the first thing you did? And I've had Garth Jennings on. I love Garth. He's amazing. So how did that all come about? Like, you grew up in London, right? Was acting always the goal and the thing?
Yeah, you know, I was really lucky. I mean, I refer to Garth as sort of my film dad in a sense, and Garth Jennings and Nick Goldsmith, who made up Hammer and Tongs, being my kind of film parents. They were incredible to me, gave me a huge opportunity by, you know, giving me a part in Son of Rambo. And I was at school not really enjoying it whatsoever.
Right.
Finding it quite depressing at school, actually, just to be... And I should say that I was lucky in the sense that I went to a really nice school. My dad, you know, worked out of his skin to get me there.
Yeah.
But I just found myself in an environment where not being good at anything,
right,
and feeling inadequate across the board was really scary. Because I think at 11, 12, 13, I was having almost like my midlife crisis then. I was sort of having a quarterly life crisis. And
it's a strange world at that age when there is kind of pressure on. So what do you want to do for the rest of your life?
Totally. And
I don't particularly want to do anything at the moment.
Right. Exactly. I want to be a kid. And I think I was sort of potentially being sort of prematurely existential and thinking beyond the school walls.
Yeah.
Arguably too early on, but it really got me down, because I was like, okay, this is my life for the next 6-7 years probably.
Yeah.
And I hate it already, and I don't see anything changing. So I think discovering drama and being able to perform even just one lesson a week was the reason I got out of bed. Amazing. And the reason I kind of got through the week.
Yeah.
And the thing that I just loved, and the only time I really felt comfortable actually and happy and confident. And I had two incredible drama teachers. But early on, it was Laura Lawson, who originally performed under the name of Laura Black, and she created School of Comedy.
Yeah.
From a kind of...
Which is where I first saw you.
Oh, was it? Okay.
And became aware of it.
Right.
For anyone that doesn't know, School of Comedy wasn't a kid's show by any means.
No.
Really. It was just a comedy show, but it happened to have children or young people as the cast. I remember at the time just thinking, oh, that's great. I mean, I remember just hearing about it. I think this could be really hit and miss because you're dealing with brand new performers. But if it hits, then that could be an amazing thing, right?
Bro, I'm telling you, that's exactly the reaction from people. It was kids doing adult comedy, and that was the sell.
Yeah.
And it was almost like a sort of Bugsy Malone sketch show.
Yes.
Yeah. I think an early kind of like reviewer, like, described it. And you know, we started as an after school club on the school premises, and it was all kids that went to that school. And
amazing.
Our first gig was like assembly, and then it was the like summer fair, and then it was like, oh, this dodgy attic above a pub says that they've got a theater and they want to like, you know, give us a spot on the bill. They're doing a comedy night, boom, and we'd go there and we'd do that, and then we'd maybe do another kind of like sort of, you know, upstairs theatre, you know, in a pub or something like that. And that kind of escalated. And then we ended up going to Edinburgh Festival. And I remember flying Edinburgh Festival, and we would just fly it and fly it and fly it and fly. I mean, all day we just had these stack of flyers, and it would be, you know, the School of Comedy written across it. And at Edinburgh Festival, which is amazing, by the way, you must have been there.
Yeah, I love it. I got back from there a week ago. The first time I've gone just to watch people. So yeah, I adore it. It's an amazing place.
If anyone's listening who hasn't been to Edinburgh Festival, like I couldn't recommend it more highly. But flying away, begging people to come in, and you could see people look at it, and they saw the kids adult comedy, or it was, I can't remember our exact tagline. It was something along the lines of adult comedy, not for kids, done by kids, or something like that. Something smoother and slicker than that. And you could just see people, I mean, often people just grab it, kind of laugh at it, and literally throw it away in front of us. Yeah. But we...
It's cutthroat up there, man. It's
cutthroat, man. And our first night, oh my God, I remember we were performing in this, like, I mean, it was a caravan with no wheels, basically. It was this massive sort of empty caravan, and it probably had sort of 60 seats, and it was huge, you know, for a caravan, but it was a very small venue. Yeah. It was probably the smallest venue in the Pleasance, which is kind of that sort of main sort of courtyard area. And I remember when we walked out and there were like 12 people, you know, and it's like, all right, 12 people took a chance on us. It's our first show. It could be worse. It could be 11 people.
Yeah.
You know, it is what it is. But we ended up having a sellout show by the end of the month. And we were on the sellout board, this little caravan with these kids in it, and we ended up selling out the festival, and we were on the sellout board for like the last 2 weeks, and you couldn't get in, and everyone was talking about School of Comedy, and we were like, what the hell is going on?
It's amazing,
you know. And then when we were flying, like, we'd be flying and then people were like, oh, can we get a picture with you? And at like 11-12 years old, there's nothing that gasses you up more than someone saying,
that's amazing.
Do you know what I mean? It was crazy for us. And then for people to sort of react like that was nuts. And then from there came BBC Comedy Shuffle. We did a spot on that. And then we had our first series on E4. So it was a roller coaster. And that kind of coincided with that sort of the Edinburgh side of things happened before I did School of Comedy. The timeline's a bit blurry for me. Before I did Son of Rambo, I went off and did Son of Rambo. I came back and then we shot our first season. So, you know, I was so lucky, man. And at that point, I guess I'd found what I really wanted to do, and I'd had an enormous amount of luck and support, you know.
Did it kind of turn your head at all and make you feel potentially comedy was the calling, or was acting specifically always kind of the feeling and drive? Because it's a tough one. Again, if you're going up on stage and making people laugh,
yeah,
that's an addictive thing, right?
Yeah.
That's an addictive thing. And then saying, oh, do you want to come and be on set for 6 months and
right.
be in a trailer and not getting that instant reaction?
Yes, yeah, 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 right. That instant gratification that comes with performing like comedy performing. Live, particularly, you know, I mean, you know, I don't need to tell you about kind of like audience feedback and stuff. It's a lovely thing to have, and it's an amazing energy to feed off. And Edinburgh is wonderful for that reason in particular.
I was talking about it the other day with Paddy Considine, who's doing a Ferryman at the moment, and it's his first time doing a theatre.
Which has more stars in its reviews than The Galaxy. It's just ridiculous.
I can't wait
it?
To see it. But it looks amazing. He was saying how refreshing it is because of he's always done, and obviously he's got his band, how he's played live, but acting wise, it's always been TV and film.
Mm.
And it is a weird world, as you're on at the moment. Mm. You're promoting something that you made a year or so ago, right? And now you're on to the next project that you're filming, and you've got today off, but you were on set yesterday. So it's that weird world of, even if it's the most exciting project in the world, by the time you're having to go around and do interviews about it, you're probably your mind somewhere else, or your focus is on something else. Whereas with live performance, you're getting it all there and then. It's all in that moment. Literally, as you're saying those words out loud, you're getting that reaction. You're getting the gasp. You're getting the silence. You're getting the laughter.
Yeah.
So it's a different. It's a different. It's a very a different medium, I guess.
It's mad, man. Yeah, and Edinburgh Festival in particular is like just so immersive, because if you're not performing, I think then you're going to go check out a mate's show or you know, the other thing that people are talking about.
It's fitting it all in.
It's and then it's just trying to sort of schedule it.
I found out that the reason, because I've only done Edinburgh once, and when we're booking it, I coming from a working class background, they were like, oh, what day off do you want each week? And I was like, it's an hour a night. Like, every day is a day off, mate. So they kind of forced me to have a couple of days off, and you realise the reason for day offs is because of stuff you're clashing with, to go and watch, to go and enjoy these things, because that was the bit that annoyed me. It's like, oh, I'm on at 9 or whatever. Everyone I want to see is on at 9, so I'm not going to get to see anyone ever. Or there's these slight crossovers, because you have to write off really anything that starts from 7 till about 10. Because you've got this whole block. Yeah. So.
And also it feels kind of irresponsible, doesn't it, to be out at a show moments before you're supposed to be
prepping
for yours or whatever.
Yeah, as if you're not going to put in a performance.
Yeah, you can't run on and be like, sorry, I was just checking out this unbelievable
sketch really
show.
You've really got to check it out. It's fantastic. But anyway, where were we?
Where were we? Yeah. Oh, you've been sat here for 10 minutes and you've paid £15. I love live performance, and I miss it for, I think, that reason that you don't get that kind of... You don't get to feed off that energy, and it's such an intimate relationship with the audience that you truthfully don't really get with film or television, I don't think. So I miss that, and I would love to revisit it. I mean, we've talked about maybe doing a kind of like school of comedy reunion, and we've joked about like University of Comedy or
whatever, you know.
Or kind of even sort of like, I don't know, elderly people home, like school of comedy or something. I don't know. We've joked about it. Being something that, you know, we certainly won't write off in the future, but any excuse to perform live again, I'm all ears to it.
I love that. I mean, I don't want to gloss over anything, but we're going to have to, because we've only got a certain amount
of
time.
Of course.
I like the variation of your career path and the things you've got to do from live to TV, but things like Chronicles of Narnia, that being obviously a huge production, to a great little indie in Wild Bill and stuff like that. But one I wanted to get to was We Are the Millers, because that was one that I slung on, not expecting too much, it's going to be some American comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
And number one, it slayed me. I thought it was great. It was one that I was ready to switch off, but I thoroughly was laughing all the way through. I had that a lot with it's going to sound odd, but I love watching anything with Kevin Hart or The Rock in.
Because
they're both kind of people that I shouldn't enjoy. It should be so basic or throwaway. Everything they seem to do, it's got such good heart and such good humour that it wins me over. And We Are the Millers was one that made me go, oh shit, that kid from School of Comedy and from these other things is... It felt like a real launch pad for you, or attention thing to say, look, you're not just this British... young child, you're
right
a versatile actor as such.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, that's crazy because I think that was the reaction of a select number of people from the UK, at least, because, you know, I mean, School of Comedy far from took over the world, but like there were a few people in the UK might have been like, oh, that's your man off the TV show from a while ago that was on before Skins. Okay, cool. but for virtually everyone else, it was, who the hell is that kid? Like, it's Jennifer Aniston, Jason Sudeikis, Emma Roberts, and who the hell is that? So I'm really grateful, and it's not lost on me, you know, just how much of a risk that New Line took by casting me, you know, and Rawson particularly, who really went to bat for me, Rawson Marshall Thurber, who's amazing. The director, who actually went on to do Central Intelligence with The Rock.
And
Kevin Hart, yeah.
Brilliant.
So they took a massive gamble on me, and I'm really grateful for that. But it's funny because as much of a launch pad as that was, I think for a long time, the only thing that came across my desk was the dorky or the nerdy or the less socially popular, according to whatever ridiculous standards young people have for cool these days, you know, role. It was always the bullied kid in the hallways of a high school, and that's, you know, that is what it is. But as much of a launch pad as it was, I think that's made the getting of other roles slightly harder, and I think you know, I still online like have people be like, oh, what eyebrows is in this movie, you know, like things like that, or like I remember when The Revenant like came out and people were like, oh, what eyebrow kid, you know, and I think if you type in weird eyebrow actor into Google, and I know this because not only have my friends, you know, quite rightly mocked me about it, but I actually get sent it regularly online, like people sort of with like either kind of memeing, if that's the correct term, my eyebrows or sending me like screenshots of these sorts of searches as if I haven't seen it before. But it's interesting, as much of a massive opportunity that was, it did put me in a box that I've worked quite hard to try and sort of clamber out of,
but yo,
without having shaved my eyebrows off.
It's good to be able to be Googleable, right?
Maybe.
There's a lot of actors that you couldn't search, and do you know what I mean?
It's like, I don't know, it's weird. There's one in particular, it would be wrong not to mention it. There's one in particular, it's taken from a screenshot of The Maze Runner, and I'm looking up, kind of squinting, and my eyebrows just start to lift up my forehead, and then they start to just move slightly off my face entirely, and then it becomes an eagle that just flies away. And at that point, you've just got to give it up to the internet. Whoever did that, well fair played. Play. Fair play to you.
How was The Maze Runner to work on? Because that was, again, another film. It seems to be a habit. Not that I have low expectation of you, but it was another one that I slung on just like, all right, this is on Sky, I'll give it a look. I really enjoyed it. And again, it's in that time where we're getting these kind of epic young adult films,
right,
which weren't really a thing before. If it was a kid's film, it was a kid's film.
Right.
If it was a grown-up film, it was a grown-up film. But we, because of I mean, looking at Maze Runner and Hunger Games and things like this, that are these huge epic things, not just it's a kid's movie, you know. I thought it was great fun.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I was excited to be involved in it. And I think that's largely because it struck me as an opportunity to be part of a, you know, big kind of blockbuster, but a big blockbuster that didn't neglect its duties to comment on society. And I think the bar was set by Hunger Games in many respects. I think Hunger Games made some really clever comments about the media, some really astute political statements being made by Hunger Games, and Maze Runner seeked to kind of do the same thing, and I feel like it also came to me at a time where young people in the UK were kind of banding together, not always in the best way, you know. I mean, the kind of riotous behaviour of certain young people during the political instability you faced a few years ago, like, I'm not condoning that, but it came across, you know, my desk at a time, so to speak, I don't have a desk, when I felt like, cool, by being part of this, by being part of this young cast who are representing characters who are kind of slightly fighting the system and rebelling against the political regime of Wicked, which is the kind of the overbearing force in The Maze Runner. I kind of felt like I was doing something relevant.
Yeah.
And that was really exciting. And then, you know, besides that, I got to work with Kaya Scodelario, who I love from Skins.
Yeah.
Dylan O'Brien, who is incredible. Thomas Brody Sangster, who's an amazing actor. Amela Mean, who's phenomenal. Dexter Darden, who's become one of my close friends. Ki Hong Lee's become one of my close friends. Chris Sheffield. I mean, too many Alex Flores, too many like amazing, talented young people to mention. Yeah. And then the other thing, man, was to see a young guy like Wes Ball, you know, in his late 20s, make one, I think it was a 1 8-minute entirely animated film as a student, win the student Oscar, and then be handed $40 million to go and make the first of a three-picture series of films based on his, based on nothing but his talent, you know.
I love that that's happening at the moment. I did a podcast in America with, and I've forgotten his name, Jordan something, who directed Kong, Skull Island.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and that
yeah.
was like his second film. He'd made like a couple of small indies.
What?
And then was suddenly, and talking to him backstage, him saying, yeah, I've suddenly got some of the biggest and greatest actors in the world under my direction. And
amazing.
I love that people are putting that faith in new talent.
That's it, man.
One more I want to talk about, because again, it's a great departure from all of these. Beginning of 2016, I was cast in a TV show called Taboo, which I was hugely excited to be involved in. My first day, I'm getting my costume done.
Forgive me, man, I haven't seen it yet.
It's great fun, and Tom Hardy pops in, and we've chatted a bit in the past, and he pops in to say hello, and he's like, oh, I've got to go. I've got to fly out for the Oscars for The Revenant, because it was up for everything. How was that as something to be involved in? The cast was amazing. The gruelingness of the way it was shot and where it was shot and all that seemed like, it felt like you've been cast in this huge blockbuster, but goddamn, can no one question any artistic merit or artistic approach or anything to it. So how was that as being cast previously in, as a nerd, as this, as
right,
that.
Right.
It must have been a great one, right?
Man, so mad. Even now, like, I actually think back to the moment I found out, and I was staying on my brother's couch at the time in Shepherd's Bush, and I was up, awake, barely able to sleep, because I heard there might be some news on the next phase of casting about The Revenant. So I was just excited to have had the opportunity to tape, for that tape to have been seen by the director, and then meet him. And I probably met him 2 weeks prior in London or whatever. And then I heard from my agent, he played it kind of nicely. He was like, oh, there's going to be some news on the next stage. And I was like, oh, cool. Like, maybe I'll get to fly out to LA and audition or something like that. And I found out that I got it. And
amazing.
Man, I jumped on my brother's bed like it was Christmas or something like that. Like, to find out that I get to work with Tom Hardy, with Leonardo DiCaprio, with Alejandro, you know, the director, and Chivo Emmanuel as the DOP, like, it was dream come true stuff. And it sort of felt like, to be honest, it was in a moment of pure elation. And then the instant feeling I was suddenly struck with was like, okay, I better not fuck this up. Secondly, like, has this come too soon? Like,
right, that's interesting.
You know what I mean? Like, am I ready for this? And this is something that I've always dreamed of doing. I've always wanted to work with Leonardo DiCaprio. I've always wanted to work with Tom Hardy. But it's happening now, and I'm 22. Like, can I actually do this? Can I really rightfully say that I've earned it as
it's
well?
It's mad to think that at that point, as much as you had those doubts, you had 10 years in the game. You know what I mean? That's insane to think that you'd been doing it that long, that you are young, but you've got that experience there.
Yeah, I suppose so. That's true. And then you're kind of reminded of the fact that it's come arguably prematurely, but it's come nonetheless, and you have to heap up the responsibility, and 100%. You're doing a disservice to everyone if you don't make the most of it and grab it with both hands.
Got to make you up your game, yeah. In that situation, you go, yeah, oh, right, man. I need them and this is what I would be thinking, not with, I need them to think I belong here.
Man.
I need to trick them into thinking I belong here.
That's what it is, bro. Yeah. I need to, that was exactly what it is. Can I fool them to think, into thinking that I actually deserve my place here? And do you know what? It wasn't until I worked with Leonardo DiCaprio, and that's not to say for a second I haven't worked with some phenomenal actors, but it wasn't until I worked with Leonardo DiCaprio that I fully appreciated what it means when people say, oh yeah, they made me raise my game, etc. Like, I've said it before and I've meant it, but no one has, you know, just inadvertently forced me into a position where I feel like I'm operating at my best because of just what they are doing is so powerful. And I would say the same thing about, I mean, the vast majority of the entire cast on Detroit, but particularly the individuals involved in the shooting of the Algiers Motel incident. Like, the performances of the people around me were so incredible that, you know, it just makes your job so much easier, is the point.
When I was making Taboo, again, it was the third thing I'd ever been cast in, and both Stephen Graham and Tom Hardy at points took me aside and gave me some tips and really helped me up my game, and both of them said that Leo had done that to them when they felt Leo is next level. And they were saying it's that important thing. He made them want to up their game, but was also accommodating to that option, to that being a thing, not kind of, you can't up your game because I own the board. Do you know what I mean? It's like helping everyone to up their game. And that must be key to a project like that, to feel that you can up your game and push yourself and not kind of just be like, all right, I'll just
step back here, man.
I'll let you do your thing.
100%. Like, I really think the most successful creatives are collaborators. In fact, I would say the most successful people are collaborators.
Yeah, 100%.
To whatever extent they collaborate, but they need to collaborate. You need to recognize that however individual a pursuit may seem, you owe it to other people somewhere along the line and at certain stages. Leo's a collaborator, and that's what was crazy to me, man, is like, you know, when I've worked with people like Leo, and this is very true of Catherine Bigelow as well, when they turn to you and say, what do you think? Like, it's a mental thing. It's like, you, first of all, you care what I think. Yeah. Secondly, you want my opinion. You may even consider it going forward. Like, that's a lovely thing. But I think they recognize the power in other perspectives, different vantage points, and what they can learn from those.
And that makes them so successful. It takes so much strength and confidence in yourself to be open to that. Again, not to try and bring it around to me at all, but I had exactly the same on one particular day on Taboo when it was Tom Hardy, Tom Hollander, and the script editor, who I can't remember her name, but had worked on some of the most amazing things. And the three of us are discussing this scene, or the four of us, the three of them are discussing this scene.
Right.
And then they asked me what I thought. And I suggested a couple of bits, and we went with one of the ones I've suggested. And I, honestly, I got home and text about five different people saying, man, they let me say, like, number one, they let me say anything. But number two, I said something that helped. It meant the world. Yeah, it just pushes that confidence. But it takes great confidence from them to open up and go, oh, what do you think? And what do you think? Because if they have to, they will say, well, no, that was wrong. Mm. We're going to stick with what we were doing. Mm, but to have that confidence to open it up, to be aware that other people can have some positive input here.
Yes.
Thing. I mean, I'd also add that if Google was around in the 90s, around the Basketball Diaries time, I'd argue if you Googled eyebrows, kids, Leonardo DiCaprio might have come up then. So I think there's some kinship there, that when he was the young star, I think that might have been the case. That's so funny.
I mean, that's hilarious. I'll take that. I'm not sure how kind Leo will find that parallel, but I'll certainly agree with you.
I'll start to wrap things up now and just ask kind of, what's ahead? What are you working on at the moment? It's always a tough one with actors because often you can't talk about what you're working on. But what's the future coming?
No, cheers, man. So I'm kind of on the brink of wrapping a film called The Little Stranger at the moment.
Yeah.
Which is being directed by Lenny Abramson.
Yeah.
I'm actually working with Donald Gleeson again. First time we worked together was Revenant. And
oh, wow. Yeah.
And Ruth Wilson.
And Ruth Wilson, yeah, completely.
Charlotte Rampling, playing that. It's an amazing cast. And Lenny Abramson's just like... Lenny Abramson's just like one of those human beings that I met and was just so massively struck by how kind of... sort of sensitive and intelligent and just nice he is.
Yeah.
And I'm a fan of Frank. I'm a fan of Room. I'm a fan of what Richard did. Like, I love his work as well. So it's kind of just all too perfect that I'm working with him, and I feel really grateful. And then after that, kind of continue to sort of promote Detroit as it continues to kind of come out.
Yeah, of course.
But otherwise, I think a little bit of a break towards the end of the year.
That's great. It's always good.
That's the plan, man.
I think one of the most exciting things about this industry is when you realise that there's a never-ending... Like, the project that you are most excited to get, you've not even heard of yet. Because it's a question that gets asked a lot in interviews, is if you could get one role. And the fact is, most of the things I've been up for, and I've been up for loads of things and not got them, but the excitement of being up for this stuff and going... I didn't even know that existed a year ago. So if you'd asked me a year ago, I would have said, I want to be in a Marvel film, Star Wars, you know, all these predictable things. Right. But then these things come up that you're like, oh my God, I want to be involved in this more than anything. And projects like you're working on now, it's the thing that a couple of years back, that wouldn't have been on your this is death, because you wouldn't have known it was happening. And that's an exciting thing, right? To know that whilst you might not know what's around the corner, you've been in the game long enough to have a level of confidence that there's probably something really fucking good around the corner. Yeah.
Which is a crazy thought. I think we're very lucky that we're in positions, you know, as far as kind of actors are concerned, whereby you have a job position that is never, ever fully defined or limited. And like, you know, you can be a nurse in the summer, and then you can be dragon come fall. You know, deep in winter, you're US Marine. It's like crazy that you get to, of course, not fully fulfill those people's jobs, because you couldn't as an actor. You couldn't amount to what a nurse does or what a US Marine does in the fullest sense. But to just be able to occupy those psychologies just for a moment and continue to do so for a long period of time is a true blessing.
And it's a beautiful thing that I watched a documentary recently called Old Man Crazy to Paint, and it's about this amazing a Japanese artist, and one of the things he speaks in there is I won't go into crazy detail, but at the age of 60 he was one of the most successful artists. And at the age of 60, he decided everything he'd done up until then was crap, and he was just getting the idea of it. And and that by 70, or no, by 80, he would be a really good. By 90, he would be a master, and by 100, every brushstroke would be perfection. And it inspired and excited me, because there was a comment in the documentary that said that art is an old man's game, because it's something. It's not like sport, where you can get to a peak and then deteriorate. It's not, and there's a lot of jobs like that. And it excited me hugely about acting, because I had a role I was up for last week, and I didn't get it, and I was really excited about it. But the excitement when I didn't get it, of the fact that, oh man, when the next role comes about, I'm going to be even better and even more ready.
Yeah,
and it's a similar thing with The Revenant. When that came about, you may have felt nervous, but you're there now, and you are ready. How I don't know, it's just that excitement of that then. Imagine what in 10 years time, how much you're going to improve, how much better. And it's a beautiful thing in this industry that is, it's different in many ways for men, because there is, again, it's a climate that needs to be redressed, but
women
in this industry do have more of a time limit, it would seem, whereas but I mean,
which does,
it's an exciting thing on the skill level. It is something that really, the longer you're doing it, the better you should be doing it. So the films you're making in 10 years should, from your perspective at least, be you know, the greatest above all expectation, and that's an exciting thought.
Yeah, yeah. I hope so.
Well, perfect. Well, where can people keep up to date with you on social media and Twitter, Instagram, all that kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm on Twitter. I recently just joined Instagram just because just to kind of get behind Detroit fully. Yep. Twitter for sure, and I would just say Detroit, if you're listening in the UK, is out already. And it's out in the US, and it'll continue to kind of hopefully be shown throughout the year in various different parts of the world. Europe is still yet to be released, and Australia, I think it's coming in October. So yeah.
And I mean I'd add on that as I said earlier, the importance of seeing things in the cinema from a looking forward point of view is one thing, but even throwing that aside, it's Detroit in the 60s, so the music is amazing.
And dumping.
It's like, it makes a difference in the cinema. And then the other thing, as I touched upon, the lightness and fun and party atmosphere, up until a point, was something that surprised me and excited me, because it is the fact that it is during a period of riots, but humans maintain and continue on. Whilst it might come to mind initially, it's not going to be a case of, oh, there's riots, everyone's at home sad or in the street smashing things up. It's like, no, you've still got to party, enjoy yourselves.
Totally, man.
Be light and take it all in your stride, cunning, and not let it get on top of you. So, as heavy as a film it is, there's also a lot of lightheartedness in it. So, yeah,
100%.
I recommend people catch it.
Thank you, man. And I think that's the reason it's called Detroit, you know, is because, you know, it gives credit where credit's due, and that is to the people of Detroit who bounce back from, you know, immeasurable kind of obstacles that a lot of cities, you know, would have possibly been beaten by. And it's called Detroit because they maintain their spirit, you know, they maintain their pride, and they really are truly progressing. So that's the reason it's called that, in my eyes.
I love it. I'll end on the quote from my mate who came along to the premiere, and we just watched this amazing film, we've been moved, and it finishes, there's been applause in the cinema, and he just went over and went, so is that set before or after RoboCop? There we go. I'll let you decide that yourselves, guys. Thank you very much for coming and chatting.
Thanks so much for having me on, man. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Scroobish Picks Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was Will Poulter. What a lovely lad, right? Interestingly, we didn't get around to talking about it, but where we recorded it is the room at his agent's where he's recorded. He's gone on tape every time he's auditioned for a role. So when he auditioned and got his place in The Revenant, it was in that room. And when he auditioned for Detroit, it was in that room. And when he auditioned for We Are The Millers, it was in that room. So it was a good spot to go and have a really relaxed conversation. So, yeah, hope you enjoyed that one. As said, I'll be back next week with Eddie Izzard. And then there's just a wealth of exciting people to come. Please do come to Dublin, the Dublin Podcast Festival. I'll be there doing Distraction Pieces the first time in Ireland, the only time this year, possibly for a year or two, at the Dublin Podcast Festival on September 21st. So come along to that. I'll see you there. And I'll see you next week. Ta-ta.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.